Our last speaker for the formal part of this session is David Friedman, professor of economics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University.
I should perhaps start by saying that for me the most interesting part of this meeting has to do with people and not with ideas. I have long firmly believed, on the direct evidence of my own eyes, that David Meiselman and Murray Rothbard were obviously the same person. Now, there is an attempt here today to persuade me that this is a false proposition, but I am sure they do it with mirrors. In discussing libertarian economics and conservative economics, I have a couple of problems. The first is that libertarians do not always agree with each other, and you may find me slipping when I discuss libertarian economics to mean, of course, my libertarian economics. I will perhaps take up that point a little more later. There is also the problem, of course, that in discussing conservative economics, since those are the economics that I presumably don't believe in, I have to decide what are the views I'm going to attribute to my opponents. To clear away a little underbrush, there is one thing which is sometimes called conservative economics, which is simply bad economics. I mean by that businessmen arguing for tariffs, saying we're conservatives and we want tariffs on our product to save America but not others, and people who argue that deficit spending automatically creates inflation, various people who are conservatives and who make arguments they find politically or financially useful, which purport to be economic. That's not what I'm going to talk about. What I will treat as conservative economics is roughly what the other two speakers have been saying earlier on in this session. That is the approach to economics, which is basically pro-free market, but which believes that there are certain fundamental functions which must be done by government, and which argues for those essentially on the grounds of showing, I think often correctly, that the market will not perfectly provide certain things, or provide less of something than would be desirable, and then jumping, I think incorrectly, to supposing that we can expect government to do better. So I think if I try to state what I perceive in general terms to be the distinction between the conservative approach to economics and what I would like to see as the libertarian approach to economics, it is that the conservatives tend to make what I regard as the fundamental mistake which the liberals always make in trying to apply economics to the question of what government should do. That is to say, they ask, will the market do the right thing? And if the answer is perhaps not, they then say, well, let us have the government do the right thing. That means that they are treating the market as a system that has a logic of its own and does whatever it'll do. But the political system is always a little black box where you could turn a dial and say, do good, and it would go out and do good. Whereas one ought properly to analyze the political system the same way we try to analyze the economic system. You attempt, and this is a harder job because Adam Smith happened to work on economics instead of politics, and so did Ricardo, and so did Marshall. So we've got to start partway at the bottom again, now analyzing politics. But you try to start assuming that people in politics, and that includes voters, lobbyists, politicians, everybody, are more or less pursuing their own ends as they perceive them, that they're reasonably rational about how they try to do that, given costly information and public good problems and all sorts of other things, and then to predict what government will do. That, it seems to me, is the right approach. And that if you look at matters from that standpoint, you may become much less optimistic about the ability of government, given imperfect knowledge and human selfishness and so forth, to improve on the performance of the free market. At the same time, I think one also has to be aware of the fact that institutions do get created. That the fact that I haven't thought of how something should be done doesn't mean that the market won't find a way of doing it. It might be the market won't find a way. I don't want to argue that the market is in any sense perfect. But the fact I haven't figured out how doesn't mean it won't. And I should say that what converted me to anarchy, essentially, was reading a science fiction book. And the reason it converted me was that before I read that book, I thought I had proved, as my colleagues here believe they have proved, that there were certain things that could not be done without the government. And in this book, I was told a plausible story about how in a particular society, not mine, but a believable society, it was possible to do these things without government. Well, if you've got an absolute a priori proof, it's got to apply everywhere. And if anybody can show you a single counterexample, even a fictional counterexample, as long as it's logically self-consistent, then you don't have a proof. And you would better start thinking about whether maybe the possibility for market institutions to do certain things is greater than you think. So therefore, I would say that the two essential differences are, on the one hand, that the libertarian tries to include government as inside the analysis rather as the thing which he assumes will do what he tells it to, and that he tries to be more nearly open to the fact that outside the framework of exactly what the institutions are he's used to, there may be opportunities for the market to solve problems that it's not obvious it can solve. Now, let me go on to apply this to a few particular questions, and to a considerable extent they're the same sorts of questions that have already been discussed on this panel. I'll start with banking. I was rather struck by the suggestion that without a government one could not have standardization of money. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm speaking a language. It's called English. In order for me to communicate in this language, you and I have to have a degree of standardization which is astronomically higher than the standardization necessary to have many banks putting out a common monetary unit. All right? It's relatively trivial. If it turns out that there are strong economic reasons why people want different banks' monies to exchange it one for one, which I think there are, it's relatively trivial for each bank to say, my money is defined as 5 grams of gold. All right, well, his money is defined as 5 grams of gold, so I'll define my money that way, and so forth. All right? And in such a system, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be a fractional reserve system. I do not share the views that Professor Rothbard at least at one time expressed about the evil, fraudulent nature of fractional reserve banking. As far as I can say, if the bank prints on the notes, fractional reserve bank, we believe we will be able to pay you 5 grams of gold on demand. We've always managed to do it before. We've been in business for 45 years, but you're taking your risks. That is not a fraudulent activity. And I would say that if they don't print that, and you have a checking account and they are paying you interest, that if you cannot figure out that they don't have your money piled in the vaults, that's your problem and not their problem. It's not fraud if you wish to deceive yourself about things that are obvious. All right. So I don't see any reason why one could not have a competitive system in which private banks operating with fractional reserve all chose to define their money in terms of the same unit or a very small number of units. Under such a system, I would expect that if one bank lowered its fraction to a dangerously low level, or for that matter, if it kept a fixed 20% fraction but used the rest of the assets to play the stock market, that the information would spread. Its money would begin selling at a discount against other monies. It would therefore become less in use. And I would point out that producing money is something you can make money out of, make wealth out of. That is to say, if I am producing a slightly more attractive money than you are, meaning a money which is a little bit more reliable, or has some other advantages, we can include in money checking accounts that pay interest and so forth, I get assets from you. That is, when I put out the money, I get things in return. Those assets can earn interest, and the result is that producing money is indeed a profitable activity, and producing stable money is a profitable activity. Now, it is certain, I shouldn't say it's certain true, I believe it is true, I believe it is a correct economic proposition that the lowest cost way of providing a monetary system is to have a governmental fiat money, because that doesn't tie up any gold at all, which is perfectly stable. It is also true that we could solve our energy problems very, very easily and cheaply by using a system of hydroelectric power based on rivers that went down the dam and then ran back uphill to the top of the dam. All right. Unfortunately, I don't think that's a viable option. And similarly, if you're going to talk about costs, the question is not, is a fractional reserve system costless? It isn't. A fractional reserve system has a mechanism to guarantee the bank's honesty, namely the bank agreeing to give you a certain amount of gold in exchange for the paper. That mechanism costs something. However, unfortunately, as we are observing, governmental fiat systems don't have a mechanism to assure the bank's honesty. And I would rather have the mechanism at a cost than not have it, because the result is the cost of an unstable money. And it simply, I don't think it's a true statement that producing a stable money is a pure public good. there are elements of public good. There will be some people who use your money to define contracts without holding any of it. But if you have a stable money, there will also be lots of people holding it, and you make money off of them because you are, in effect, getting a loan from them by giving them your money and getting goods in exchange. All right? One final point on the question of the possibilities of competitive money. There is something to be said for looking at the real world and history. There's a delightful essay by a fairly well-known economic historian, which is called The Dollars of the Middle Ages. And in it, he traces out, starting about 700 AD, how one after another of the national monies became the dominant international currency, and how over time, when one of them became less stable, less reliable, began to get debased, other national currencies took over, so that you had a sequence beginning with the numisma, the gold Byzantine coin, with the Arabic dinar rising to be competitive with the numisma. There was a period when both were circulating. With the numisma eventually declining, being largely replaced by the florin and the ducat, and so forth. So that, in fact, we do have some example. This happened over a long period of history. It also happened in a society where communication was much, much slower than it is now. But one can have such things happening. Now, let me go on to the question of police, not the particular questions that Arch Enfield raised, although they are certainly interesting and in some cases difficult ones, but rather to the question of what are the questions that occur to a libertarian looking at the police system. The questions that occur to a conservative, in particular a conservative non-economist, are questions such as what powers should the police have, should they be allowed to enter without knocking to arrest people, and so forth and so on. The question that naturally occurs to a libertarian is, we observe here a socialist industry, protection against crime. We observe a very poor quality of product. Is there some way of converting this industry to something closer to a free market industry, and thus allowing the forces of the market to protect us from crime? I have an article forthcoming in the Journal of Legal Studies, I think in their next issue. The article is almost entirely historical. It is a description of a real-world society in which for 300 and some years, all enforcement of the law was private. Now, before you tell me this is an absurd idea, let me point out that in the society you live in, quite a lot of enforcement of the law is private. The whole civil law system is a system in which people who believe the law has been violated and who believe they are the victims hire a lawyer, can collect evidence, and take somebody to court. No police involved at all. So one has a criminal system, which I'm talking now not about the court system, but merely about the police power, a criminal system which is a government monopoly and a civil system which is not. And I discuss, with references to a real historical example, the possibility of using private enterprise to replace the criminal part of our present court system. I'm running out of time and I have lots more things to say, so let me just say one of them. And that's has to do with the public good problem. I'm very interested in the public good problem. This is one of the areas where libertarians do not all agree, and I may perhaps be disagreeing with some libertarians and even perhaps with libertarian economists who carry more weight than I do. But I believe the public good problem is a legitimate problem, all right. But while it is a serious problem for the market, it is a catastrophic problem for the alternatives to the market. After all, when we talk about having government do something, that means we use a political mechanism based essentially on democratic voting to decide what the good thing is and to do it. All right? Well, in democratic voting, all collection of information is the production of a public good with a public of 200 million people. That is to say, if I spend any resources at all finding out what's good for the nation and voting for the guy who's willing to do it, I have just produced a public good of which I collect 1/200 millionth of the benefit. The result of this is what we call, in my part of the economic profession, rational ignorance, which means it does not pay to learn things if you don't get anything for doing it. So, very, very briefly, I think the libertarian attack on the public good problem is to say, yes, there are public goods. Yes, there are going to be suboptimal things in any real economy. However, the public good problem makes it almost impossible to construct a political mechanism that works even tolerably well, and therefore imperfect market mechanisms are likely to be better. Now, I have a whole lot of other things to say, but I'll have to say them out in the halls. Thank you.